Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, An Improved Understanding of LNAPL Behavior in the Subsurface. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator on today's call. I'm going to cover introductory material in the first few slides and then turn the presentations over to our ITRC LNAPL trainers. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we get started. We're scheduled for 2.25 hours. We are recording today's session, and we do offer archives of past ITRC training, so I would encourage you to look at the archives to see what topics are available. In today's class, the trainers control the slides. If you would like to control your own slides, you can download the presentation, and that's available back on that CLUIN training page where you started today. Throughout today's training, you are welcome to send in questions. We have a Q&A box in the lower right that you can send in a question or a comment. At the question and answer breaks, we are going to ask some of those questions out loud. If you are on the phone line, you have the, also have the option of asking your own questions out loud. At the end of the class, we do ask that everyone fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback. We're starting to develop new courses, and we're going to incorporate your feedback in as we develop those. We also have the chance to improve this training class, as we're going to offer it again. The advantage to filling out the feedback form is that you can create a certificate of participation. And right now, the only way to get that is by completing the feedback form. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended the class today. If you forget to check that box, just go back. Check the box, because once you check that box and submit the feedback, that's when the system is going to generate the certificate. And right now, the feedback form is the only way to get that. So at the end of today's training, you're welcome to fill out the feedback form, and it is available in the middle right on a related link. So to access those related links, you select the name of the link you're interested in, and then you look down a bit, you select Browse To. So that's going to allow you to open those related links anytime throughout today's class, and they'll open in a new window for you. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. Please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website about a wide variety of guidance documents that are available. We also have online training schedule for this year available. I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. Eric Gessert is the supervisor of the Petroleum Remediation Program for the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. He focuses on incorporating state-of-the-science technologies into the program, including advanced characterization techniques and conceptual site model development. Derek Tomlinson is a senior practitioner in environmental engineering and contaminant hydrogeology. He is a principal with the GEI Consultants based in Philadelphia. He has more than 20 years of experience specializing in development of strategies for managing non-aqueous phase liquids and is actively involved in development of various standards, guidance document, best practices, and online and classroom training. Eric Nichols is a principal at Substrata in Newfields, New Hampshire. He's a technical resource for LNAPL and petroleum characterization, remediation, natural source zone depletion, vapor intrusion, and litigation support. I'll now turn the presentation over to Eric Gessert at the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. Eric?
Okay. Thank you for the introductions, Juliana, and thanks, everyone, for being able to attend today's webinar. The first couple slides that I'm going to go over kind of introduce why we're all here. So in 2007, there was an ITRC LNAPL team that was created. And as sort of represented in this pie chart here, pretty 50-50 split between state and or federal partners. along with consultant and industry representatives. That's always an important concept within ITRC to make sure that that we're getting interested parties to the table to develop a consensus-based document. So why did we form an LNAPL team? As I'm sure a lot of people on the line are aware, LNAPL sites are present throughout the country, and they typically pose a unique concern in that they're very difficult to progress them toward an effective endpoint. A large part of the work that the LNAPL team did was to try to identify what are appropriate endpoints and facilitate getting those endpoints incorporated into decisions made pertaining to LNAPL management. Something that we'll discuss a little bit further as that last bullet identifies is what does the term maximum extent practicable mean when it comes to the removal of free product? So that ITRC LNAPL team that formed in 2007 put out a lot of usable resources, one of which is, of course, this webinar right now. But in April of 2009, they came out with the first LNAPL document, which was a technology overview on natural source zone depletion. That was followed up by the LNAPL technical regulatory guidance document that came out in December of 2009. Online internet-based training has been ongoing from 2010 to present day. As you are probably aware, this is part one of a three-part training series. Definitely encourage that that individuals, as best they can, attend all parts of the training because they are, they work well with each other and give a more of a comprehensive understanding of the LNAPL training ITRC put together. Another resource that ITRC had put together pertaining to LNAPL training was classroom training, and that was a very effective product which was developed, first introduced in 2011. Training went on through 2016. There currently is no plan for training in 2017, but that kind of gets, again, to the last bullet, which is an ITRC LNAPL update team. That team was formed in 2016 and is currently working on revising updating the existing LNAPL documents, which were produced in 2009. If individuals online are familiar with the products that ITRC puts out, you probably noticed that over the past couple years, they've moved to a web-based sort of evergreen platform as opposed to the printed PDF type versions. So we anticipate that the updated LNAPL documents and or guidance will be put out in the spring of 2018, and that even the training that we're taking today, it's within the purview of that update group to review those materials and make sure that they flow well with the upcoming guidance. So, as identified, there is a three-part internet-based training, and this is part one. Part one, we're really going to be dealing with understanding LNAPL behavior in the subsurface, factors that control the distribution, and we're going to talk a bit about saturation, what happens when LNAPL saturation is greater than what we identify as residual saturation, and I'll get into that in a few minutes, and then what are concerns when LNAPL is less than residual saturation. Part two, which is next, I believe Juliana said it was May 11th, so that would be next Thursday, we're going to get more into conceptual site model development and sort of the introduction of conceptual site model is used to identify what are the specific concerns we have with the LNAPL release. Those concerns then sort of get paired with goals and objectives, and part two will conclude with a brief introduction of the technologies. Part three is the following week, and that's really getting into the utilization of that 2009, that December 2009 guidance document, which was evaluating LMAP remedial technologies for achieving project goals. There are sort of two processes that are really going to be described in that Part 3 training. One of them is just an overall decision-making process that relates with the conceptual site model, the identification of concerns, identification of goals and associated objectives. And then the other major process that will be described in Part 3 is a technology selection framework, which is a very thorough framework, but ultimately the aim is to match the technologies with the identified concerns to make sure that we're using the right tool to address the problem. As mentioned, LMAP classroom training did continue through 2016. We will be evaluating if additional LMAP training will continue as a part of the update team. So most certainly not happening in 2017, but 2018, 2019, there is that potential. It was certainly one of the more popular ITRC training classes, and so it appears that there was definitely a value and a need for that class, and so we will be revisiting that concept as a part of the update team. So specifically, let's talk about what we're going to get into today. We kind of have today broken up into four sections between the three trainers. As Juliana had identified, there is going to be a question and answer session kind of right in the middle of today's presentation. But first, we're just going to get into what are the LMAP definitions and what are some of the concerns that LMAP presents. After that, we're going to specifically talk about the mechanisms of how LMAP enters soil and groundwater, how it distributes vertically, and ultimately how it moves through the subsurface both vertically and horizontally. So I've said the term LMAP quite a bit, but haven't really properly defined it. So as depicted in that image there, LMAP is a light non-aqueous phase liquid that is less dense than water, and so in a perfect world would just float on top of the water because it's less dense than it. We're not talking about DNAP, which is a dense non-aqueous phase liquid. So specifically, we're talking more about petroleum products, gasoline, diesel fuel, jet fuel, crude oil, et cetera. I like this image because while it clearly represents what LMAP is, it does not represent how LMAP actually distributes in the subsurface, which is we'll be talking about quite a bit today. But we will learn that LMAP just does not simply float on top of the water table, as was once sort of a commonly held thought. Okay. Sorry, it looked like it cut out just for a second there, but was able to capture it. So let's talk about LMAP saturation and this term residual saturation. When we typically talk about LMAP sites, we think about what is in the upper diagram here, which is we think we have LMAP at a site because there's LMAP in a monitoring well. Essentially, that is representative of LMAP at saturations that are greater than the residual saturation. But if we look at the lower image, we can see that there is no LMAP in that monitoring well, but it is depicting that you have LMAP available within the pore space. That is representative of conditions that the LMAP saturation is less than the residual saturation. The residual saturation term is pretty simply defined as LMAP will not freely drain from the soil into the monitoring well when you are at saturations below the residual saturation. The analogy here is a sponge, which is, I think, pretty easy for people to understand. If you run a sponge under a sink fully saturate the pores within that sponge, with very little applied pressure, water is just going to drain out of that sponge. You can then apply some more pressure and continue to have that water drain from that sponge. But ultimately, you're going to get to a point where the additional applied pressure that you add doesn't really result in additional water being removed from the sponge. And I think we've all experienced that exact thing, but know that the sponge is still wet, meaning that it still has moisture within the pores, and they're just not ready to drain, or it's not able to drain. And so we'll be revisiting this concept quite a bit today, and we'll further define residual saturations, concentration, and saturations above and below that that threshold, but wanted to introduce it here up front. So here's sort of a simplified conceptual site model for a gasoline release, and I sort of wanted to talk about this conceptual site model in terms of the concerns that the LNAPL body presents. As depicted, the LNAPL body itself may be advancing in the subsurface once it as we can see, we have the NAPL body itself, which may be migrating through the subsurface. We could have concerns of impact to potential receptors, and that LNAPL body is also the source of dissolved phase as well as vapor phase concerns. It's important to note that because your ultimate strategy may be to address the LNAPL body as it relates to vapor concerns that you have. That might be, what the strategy calls for. And so this image just pretty clearly represents that, the LNAPL itself is a concern, but also the various phases that it contributes to is a concern. So this is getting a little bit more into detail with the distribution of LNAPL in the subsurface. So as can be seen in the first representation at the pore scale, LNAPL shares the pore space with both air and water. So in the vadozone, generally LNAPL will drain through the vadozone. You could have a small amount or some fraction of residual saturation that LNAPL below residual saturation that remains within the pore space. But in the vadozone, largely LNAPL is sharing that pore space with some water moisture, which is adhering to the soil particles more so than the LNAPL is, and then also with air. When we get into the capillary fringe, we can see that we have a little less air and a little bit more NAPL, and also that affinity of the water to adhere to the soil particles is greater. When we move to the sort of source area, or the high LNAPL saturation area, in this image, it's depicted below the water table, so LNAPL is sharing the pore spaces with water. And again, that water is largely adhering to the soil particles, which will be subsequently discussed, but the fact that water does adhere to the soil particles makes it a bit more difficult for NAPL to move through those pore spaces because there's a little less room and a little more pressure. Sections D and section E, they kind of defined the edges, and then the ultimate sort of extent of the LNAPL distribution in the subsurface, where the dissolved phase contaminants are mixing with the water. So the concerns associated with LNAPL, as presented later in this training, we largely, ITRC, broke concerns into two major categories, compositional concerns and saturation-based concerns. Composition concerns are more your dissolved phase, vapor phase concerns that the LNAPL body may be contributing to. saturation concerns, that's where you're talking about is the Alnepo migrating through the subsurface that could present an additional risk? Is it seeping into utilities, basements, surface waters? Aesthetics is sort of defined as Alnepo in the monitoring well. We've always sort of associated Alnepo in the monitoring well as a problem by itself, but our enhanced understanding of the concerns really just identifies Alnepo in a monitoring well as a potential aesthetic concern that still may need to be addressed. Okay, so I had mentioned earlier when we were talking about some of the unique concerns that Alnepo presents, and the regulatory framework plays largely into this. The discussion of, within 40 CFR 280.64, removing free product to the maximum extent practicable as determined by the implementing agencies. We've just pulled up the results of the poll that was conducted so far in this training, and we can see we get still a bit of a varied response as to what are the specific endpoints for the agencies that you work with. It's good to see that over 50% of the responses are site-specific and or risk-based drivers, as opposed to the more difficult and really not as specific when we think about concerns, endpoints of pre-relief conditions and or measurable thickness in a monitoring well. And I would, I guess, just lastly say that we have, in the almost decade that the ITRC LMAPL documents have been put out and with continued polling and or data gathering that we do, we've really seen, a positive shift towards, risk-based site-specific endpoints that, match the endpoint that we're trying to achieve with the concern that it presents. So this is an image that one of our co-collaborators on the update team put together, and it sort of just depicts how well do our regulations address concerns presented by Alnepo. As can be seen, grabbing that clicker again, explosive conditions, emergency abatement concerns, our regulations do a pretty good job of addressing those type of concerns. When we have dissolve phase issues and or vapor migration issues, again, our regulations do a pretty good job of saying in the dissolve phase, we have these MCL standards that need to be obtained, maybe some site-specific standards that need to be obtained, and same with vapor intrusion. And now would be a good time to identify that in 2014, ITRC put out, very specific to Alnepo, a petroleum vapor intrusion guidance document. So it would encourage people to familiarize themselves with that. But what our regulations don't do such a great job of doing is evaluating the specific concern and endpoint as it relates to Alnepo migration and Alnepo recovery potential. And we will be getting into those things further today and in the coming trainings. So this is sort of the last slide that I will be presenting today. And just kind of a list of what are some common misconceptions associated with Alnepo. I sort of foreshadowed the first one, that it enters pore spaces just as easily as groundwater. That is not, in fact, the case, and Derek and Eric will get into that further. You can hydraulically recover all of the Alnepo from the subsurface. Again, not a true statement. That would be very difficult to do. The notion that Alnepo floats on top of the water table, which was historically sort of considered to be the pancake model, is not true. Alnepo can, in fact, penetrate below the water table, and quite often a lot of the mass, in fact, lies below the water table. I'm just sort of picking from the list, but Alnepo in a monitoring well, it means it's in the monitoring well, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that it's flowing through the subsurface. It just means that it's able to enter that monitoring well. And we will be getting into that further. So with that being said, I am going to turn it over to Derek Tomlinson with GEI, and he is going to start Section 2, How Alnaple Enters Soil and Aquifers.
Well, thank you, Eric, and can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Great, thank you. So good afternoon and morning, I guess, to some of you. We will move right along here, but what we're going to talk about is how Alnaple enters the soil and aquifers. So next slide. So going back to Eric's misperceptions about Alnaple, we're going to focus on the first two here. Alnaple enters the pores just as easily as groundwater, and you can recover all. And the key phrase here is all Alnaple. Next slide, 24, is what we should be on. So Eric had provided sort of this conceptual site model, simplistic conceptual site model of an Alnaple release. You have your UST here that had a release. The Alnaple is driving its way downwards, and then when it hits the water table, this driving head or this height of Alnaple will have a force that displaces both air as it's going through the vagal zone and then water once it enters the saturated zone, and will be balanced by forces that we'll talk about, pore entry pressure and buoyancy and others, that will drive it, allow it to drive deeper until it's balanced by those, and then it'll spread out laterally, all upgrading slightly because you have this head and this mounding, if you will, that allows it to go up gradient, and then typically following the water table gradient as well, which Eric Nichols will get into about some of the lateral movements and vertical distributions in his section four. But the key here that we're going to talk about is that the Alnaple must displace the existing fluid. So in our scenario, we're talking about an Alnaple that's been released. It's typically somewhat shallow. It's not where we're talking about a reservoir where there's a lot of pressure and back pressure that allow that oil to get into fine-grained soils. We're looking at a head or this elevation difference between the water table and the where the release occurred. And so it has to displace that air and water before it can get into the pores. And the Alnaple, it's easy for it to displace air and more so than water because air, and we'll talk about that, but air is non-wetting relative to Alnaple, and Alnaple is non-wetting relative to water, and we'll get into that as well in our discussion today. So moving on to slide 25. So right into the resistance of movement. So this is not the resistance you're getting from your children, but this is the resistance you're getting from your Alnaple. And shown here on the left is a photo by Wilson's work. And in the right in the middle here, you can see, get the arrow going again here. You can see this green ganglia of Alnaple. So this is a non-wetting fluid. It could be air or water, or Alnaple, I mean, Alnaple. And you can see with this curvature here, this non-wetting fluid is trying to push its way into what is the wetting fluid, which is shown here by the end of this arrow, this black space. So that wetting fluid is what's preferentially contacting the soil. So it's wetting the surface of the soil. There's a meniscus, it's hard to see here, but the soil's wetted by that wetting fluid. Let's say it's water. And this non-wetting fluid is not touching that soil grain. So looking to our right here, as far as migrating, and if we look at that ganglia, it needs to have a pressure or in a head of Alnaple, that height of Alnaple, or some other forces to allow it to exceed this pore entry pressure, this being the finer area of the pore, to go into the next pore space. So in the bottom picture, we can see that that pore entry pressure has been exceeded by the NAPL head or the NAPL capacitor pressure to allow it to enter into that pore space. So the NAPL will only move into the water-wet pores when that entry pressure is overcome by either NAPL head or other external forces. And that's why in remedies, and we will not talk about those today, but in part, a little bit in part two and in part three, more so about stressors that can be applied to the aquifer to help and enhance for recovery, if hydraulic recovery is a need for your management concern. So this also aids in understanding how it distributes vertically and how it potentially migrates laterally as well. And just of note, since in a water-wet environment, these NAPL ganglia, shown here, will preferentially be in the larger pores of the subsurface versus the connections between the grains, or the smaller pores will be where the wetting fluids will reside, and the non-wetting will be typically in the larger pores. Next slide. So slide 26. So our pore entry pressure, which we define here as the displacement head. So it's the amount of head of NAPL that is in the NAPL water system that is required to sort of squeeze the sponge, if you will, or push the water out of the water-filled pores to allow that NAPL to migrate into the next pore space, and if you're doing a remedy, to be recovered. So back on the top, we see our detailed diagram again. So that pressure front that we need, that pressure that we need to exceed, is shown here. Yes, math. I am an engineer, so I apologize. But this is basically the pore entry pressure equation, but this is our displacement head. So we need to exceed the pore entry pressure, which is a function of our wetting angle. So if we look at this little front here, there's an angle to it. So you can actually draw a line and get a little angle off of that. And our contact angle is here. And we also will have our radius and our pore size radius. And then these are our two densities, the density of water and then density of our NAPL and then gravitational forces. So this is the equation. So if we look at parameters within that equation, so it's here on the bottom table on the right-hand side, and we have our water-NAPL interfacial tension. So that's how, if you look at that tension or on the surface. So if you fill a glass of water, there's tension between the air and the water on the side of a glass. You can see that sort of rise the water up onto the glass. Well, there's a surface tension on that water, so that's what that measure is for water to air. And that similarly, water to NAPL has that same kind of relationship. So is that parameter just lost the screen.
So, Derek, it looks like you might have fallen off. But you're welcome to say the slide number, and I'll move forward. And I'll try to get you back.
Okay.
Up. You show back up.
All right. So if we look at the water-NAPL interfacial tension, as that increases, we need a higher NAPL displacement head for that. And so then the NAPL potential to enter the water-filled pore decreases. So they're directly correlated. The wettability of it is directly correlated as well to our NAPL head. So the more wetting the NAPL is, then the more likely it is to fill the pore. The larger our pore size, then the less displacement head that we need. And then lastly, the density. The higher the density of our NAPL, so closer to that of water, then our higher the NAPL displacement head is, and then we have our potential to enter the pore becomes less. I think I'm back, right, Juliana?
Looks like.
Yes, I am. Okay, sorry about, looks like I am. Yeah, I am. Okay, thank you. So basically, the higher the NAPL displacement head is, the harder it is for the NAPL to displace water from those pores. So moving on to slide 27. So if we look at some real site capillary pressures or capillary pressures, I apologize, I'm Canadian, so I have lived in the United States almost 20 years, so my accent and dialect is both. So I will say capillary and capillary. But if we look at moisture retention curves, which shown here on the left-hand side, and in the bottom left-hand side of our graph here, I'll explain the graph in a minute, you'll see our soil core. So these experiments, they're imbibition experiments. The soil core is water wet, so it's entirely saturated with water. The pore space is 100% water. And then oil, which is shown here by these red arrows at the bottom, shown here by the red arrows in the bottom, are pushing the water out. So you can see the water is leaving here by the green arrows. And so with those, then, there's a back pressure. What you can see this little gauge here. It's maybe hard to see on your screen, but this little gauge here is measuring that pressure that's needed to push the water out. So there's a, before, in these experiments, before you see water move out, there's a back pressure or that NAPL displacement head measured. And that's shown here on the left-hand side. So we have our capillary head, which is in feet of water, and our water saturation. It's going from 0 up to 100. Or you can look at the corollary of that, that we have 0 NAPL saturation here and working our way up to 100% NAPL saturation. So we're shown here are three soils. The pink is the sand. The cyan is the clay sand, and sort of this rust brown is a clay. So if we look at our displacement head, so again, that pressure reading that we needed to displace the water with NAPL, in a sand it was about 4 inches, in a clay sand it's about 10, in a clay it's 40. So as the grain size decreases, our back pressure that we need, or our head of NAPL, or the height of our release, or the pressure in that pipeline that bursts, needs to be higher as the soil grains become finer. So if we released in a pipeline in clay, it would take a higher pressure than, say, in a sand to enter into the pore. Basically what it means is that clay here shown in the first bullet, you know, it holds water more tightly, which being finer pore space, it has more surface area, it has more retention capacity of the water, so it's really difficult for the NAPL to enter that. Sand being more porous, less surface area, it holds water less tightly, so it has an easier time for the NAPL to get in there and occupy those larger pore within the soil structure itself. So basically, we're just really hard for the NAPL to displace the water from finer grain soil. And you'll see in literature examples, and that's why a lot of the literature examples are based on reservoir oil. And you'll see, and we'll talk about a little bit, is residual NAPL. In oil reservoirs and clays, they have very high residual levels. Well, in our environmental spills that are shallow in nature and NAPL didn't exist before, it's really hard for the NAPL to get into the clay to begin with. So you'll see that the saturations that we see in clay are very low typically, and the residuals are even lower. So slide 28. So how does that NAPL displacement head affect the lateral migration and vertical distribution of our LNAPL body? So that NAPL displacement head affects both the vertical distribution and how it also distributes laterally, as we just sort of discussed earlier. It also aids in explaining why NAPL bodies stabilize over time, because if there's this entry pressure that the head, the knuckle displacement head, needs to exceed, well, at some point you're not going to have enough back pressure to enter into those pores. And in our part three, I think in our part two a little bit, and then mainly in our part three, we'll talk about that natural source on depletion mechanism, which is natural mechanisms that also help with the stability. But specifically from an evective transport standpoint, the NAPL bodies are mainly stabilized by the pore entry pressure and then and enhanced by natural source on depletion. The LNAPL also needs to, displace those fluids where they're existing, because the NAPL is the new fluid on the block, right? And so it's entered in here. It has to push its way through, and sort of like the football field, has to push the blockers out of the way to get in there to get the quarterback. So it's doing the same kind of thing. It has to push the water out of the way to get into the larger pores. So, and if there's enough NAPL, then they get interconnected and we can recover it. And we see it in wells because now it's above residual levels. It's easier for the NAPL to displace the air because air relative to NAPL is non-wetting. So the NAPL is actually the wetting phase. So it's easier for wetting phases to move in the subsurface versus non-wetting. But once it gets into the saturated zone, the water is wetting to the NAPL. So the NAPL has a harder time moving around because it's non-wetting. So the soil is like, oh, don't touch me because I'm not, you're non-wetting. So it's harder for the NAPL to move around because of that. So slide 29. So we're going to move on to section three here. And we're going to talk about the vertical distribution of NAPL, and we'll just move right along. So slide 30. All right, so getting back to our common misperceptions about LNAPL, we talked about the first two, so they're now shaded out. So we're going to talk about these next three. So some of the misperceptions we hear are all the pores in the LNAPL body or plume filled with LNAPL. LNAPL floats on the water table or capillary fringe like a pancake and doesn't penetrate below the water table. Thickness in the well is exaggerated by a factor of 4, 10, 12, or pick your favorite number. So we're going to sort of talk through all these common misperceptions. So moving on to slide 31. So vertical distribution of NAPL. On our left-hand side, we see sort of a conceptualization here of the pancake model. This does not happen. Erase it from your brain if you can. We're just going to say this does not happen at all, okay? So what the pancake model implies is that this NAPL body, which is shown here in this red from the tank, is at 100% NAPL saturation in the pore. So that does not happen. I have not, in my 20-some-odd years of working, ever seen a site at 100%. I don't even think in the oil reservoir they see 100% NAPL saturation. So it just does not exist. What the pancake model assumes is that NAPL always floats, it all floats on top of this water table, and it's uniformly saturated. It just doesn't happen. What does happen is this vertical equilibrium model here on the right. You can see it a little bit in our cartooning here, that there's a variability in the saturation vertically through the profile. As we get to the water table and the capillary fringe is where we start to get our higher saturations. It's really in the formation. There's interconnected NAPL blobs and ganglia, and if we haven't elevated enough saturation, maybe some pooling of NAPL. It penetrates deeper than you think. It's below the water table, especially near at the release zone. It's deeper than you actually would think. And it coexists in the saturated zone with water, and up here in the vadose zone with water, air, and NAPL. So moving on to slide 32. So again, the one on the right is right. The one on the left is wrong. So just, I wish I, for those of you that remember Men in Black, just stare at this little device and the screen's going to flash red. So forget this pancake model. So slide 32. So saturation distribution is determined by capillary pressure. So I think most people have taken the class as fluid mechanics. So if we look at here on the left-hand side is a well without NAPL. So if we take the air and water table interface, and that's sort of shown here in this dashed line, the next well over is a well with NAPL in it, and we're going to have the NAPL, the LNAPL air interface, and that's shown by this dashed line. Okay. So if we remember from fluid mechanics, at the top of the surface of water, so where it is interconnects with air, its atmosphere is 1. So here's our atmosphere, our pressure here shown on the graph, 1 being here in the middle, and then less than 1 to the left and higher than 1 to the right. So for our water case, you know, take our dashed line over, so we're at 1 at the top of the water table. Similarly, at the top of the NAPL, we're at 1, or 1 atmosphere where the NAPL would be. So the delta, or the difference between those two lines, is our capillary pressure. And so it's the capillary pressure is the highest at our LNAPL air interface and 0 here at our water NAPL interface. So it's higher up here, at the highest up here and at our NAPL air interface, and lowest at our NAPL water interface. Okay, next slide, slide 33. So what does this mean? So if we take a look at our sort of our distribution vertically here, if we look at our top of our NAPL that we measured in the well, shown here in A, we have a poor blowout, if you will, a cartoon really, but a blowout of the, say, the granular pore structure. So we have the NAPL and water, there might be some air dispersing here, but we have our highest NAPL saturation being observed because we have our highest pressure. So it has the highest likelihood of getting into that pore structure. Remember that head, displacement head? Well, it has the highest capability to get into that pore structure here, shown by A. Now, as we move our way down, you see our capillary pressure here is getting less now as we get to the water, where the water table hypothetically would have been. So our saturation is becoming less of NAPL because we have less pressure to push into those pores. And then as we get to where the delta or the pore capillary pressure is 0 for the NAPL, we then have no NAPL. So if we move on to slide 34, and we'll introduce you to one of our famous little friends on the right-hand side here. I know you're excited. It's our shark fin. I know. I think I could hear everybody. The fanfare is great. So this is our capillary pressure predicted by saturation distribution. So we have, again, as I noted, our capillary pressure is highest at the interface, so that's where we see our peak. And they will decrease with our capillary pressure. So we have our highest saturation at that peak, and our lowest saturation where it meets the water table interface, and similarly, we have a relationship with the air in NAPL that it sort of drops off as well. So it's our capillary pressure retention curve for NAPL. So similar to water, there's just so much capacity or suction, if you will, that the napalm gets sucked up into the formation above. And to estimate then, to estimate this distribution, there's like many tools that are available to us that are available. API, the American Petroleum Institute, has an interactive guide. They also have the El Napol distribution and recovery model that will calculate this curve. And you know, word of warning, it's based on a homogeneous sand, or homogeneous aquifer, so uniform type of soil grains. So you know, you don't have the heterogeneity involved here. It's just a homogeneous isotropic kind of aquifer. But if we look back here at our left-hand side with our head, so it's below the napal head. So our napal head is too low for the napals to enter the pores, right? And we're down here. And then you know, up above here, it's again elevated. So our pore entry pressure is elevated enough to get it into the pores. So again, the key point here is that our NAPL saturation, our L-NAPL saturations, will continue to decrease with depth below the water table from the initial release. Now, if you have longer-term mechanisms happening, like, and it's an old release, and you may have confined NAPL or other issues going on, which we'll talk about in a bit. So moving on to slide 35. So grain size. So the grain size will affect how our NAPL will distribute and also our saturation. Again, assuming a uniform type of soil, so there's no heterogeneity here, so it's homogeneous. We have shown here on the left-hand side is our height of our NAPL, or height of our water NAPL interface. And then shown on bottom is our saturation. So if we look at, on the right-hand side, a well of, say, gasoline or petrol or in the well, and we assume from a pancake model, we'd have about 13 gallons per square foot over this five-foot horizon. So if we took like a foot squared and sort of cut that out straight down 5 feet, we'd have about 13 gallons. If we look at a gravel, and now we're correcting for the fact of that relationship of capillary pressure, we'll have about 6 gallons per square foot, a medium sand about 1.5, and a silt about 0.7 gallons per square foot. So if we look at the volumes based on the pancake model and we have those uniform saturations, we're significantly overestimating, even for a gravel where you would think that it's at least double. And in most cases, you know, medium sand, it's, you know, it's almost an order of magnitude higher. So for the given L-NAPL thickness, the saturations and volumes are different for different soil types, and it's greater for the coarser grain soils. But the key here with respect to volume is if we use pancake model, we're overestimating what we can actually get out of the ground. And that's not doing anyone a good service, because if you're overestimating what you can get out, then you're never going to get there. And so you're going to perpetually be remediating and just never have a realistic metric to meet your measurement objective. So moving on to slide 36. So if we also look at the inference from NAPL thickness in a well and its relative to saturation on silty sand. So for a given soil type, the higher the thickness in the well, and the higher the capillary pressure and the higher the NAPL saturation. So shown here on the left is the height of the NAPL And then we have our napple saturation on the axis. So again, the 1 foot thickness, we have a less thick saturation relative to a 10 foot thickness. So a 10 foot thickness, we'd be up in the 35 range, and the 1 foot, we're at around 2.5. You can see with other thicknesses how that changes. Slide 37. But you know, we are not in homogeneous world. But this is work by Beckett and Lungard and Huntley and others. And this is on a sandstone, which behaves, that porosity or that primary porosity behaves similarly to, you know, a homogeneous formation. So shown here in the purple or sort of pink triangles are the measured saturations, and this is our model. So you can see the shark fin here. Now on the right-hand side is these little black dots are the measured values, and this is the model for 6 different soil types. And you can see the saturation is variable relative to the type of soil. So you have really low saturations in a sort of a clay silt and higher saturations up in the sands. Next slide, slide 38. The saturations aren't uniform. So we need to remember that saturations preferentially go to the larger pores, shown here in this imagery is when we talk about in part two a little bit more about characterization methods. But this is a core that was collected for both white light, which is shown here on the left, and ultraviolet light. And so we'll get into this on part two. So a little plug for part two of explaining what this all means, but Napa will fluoresce, and we'll get into the weeds on that part two, but take my word for it. So if we look at our percent of finds in this area of the core was less than this area of the core. And so if we look over at saturations, this is percent benzene by saturation. We had about 15% in the more permeable part of the core versus the less permeable part of the core. Maximum napple saturations we typically see are, you know, in the range of 5 to 30% in sands. You know, they can be higher depending on how the release is. I've seen them higher than that where you've had a long-term constant release, but typically what you see is in the 35 to 30 range. They can be even lower in finer grain sediments, as I noted earlier with the clays and the silts, because it's just so hard for that napple to get in there. You might just 2 to 3% is probably more realistic, and maybe a little bit higher. Slide 39. So if we look at the analogy to L-napple body, again looking at our graphs that we talked about, the more napple you have, the higher the saturation. So if we look at the core of the napple, we have a thicker napple in the formation, so we'll have a higher saturation. So say, for example, we have 10 foot of thickness there. So we're going to have a higher napple thickness. Whereas on the fringes at the edges, our napple thickness is lower, and so therefore we have a lower saturation. So moving on to slide 40. The pancake versus vertical equilibrium model. So why is it important? The pancake is really overestimating what is in the formation, and that's just bad science. And, you know, you can't just say that what you see in the well is 100% of what's in the formation. The napple doesn't generally occur as that distinct little lens or layer floating on the water table, and it's not 100% across the saturation. And it gives you unrealistic expectations of what you can recover hydraulically, because in the pancake model, you're assuming that it's uniformly saturated, uniformly napoli distribution of the napple, and it's just, oh, it's so easy to get, which isn't the case. So that's why it's important to understand that the pancake model is bad and it's the vertical equilibrium model. So moving on to slide 41. For napple volume estimates, you use those to understand the scale of the problem. But they're not necessary for all sites, and again, they're still an estimate. So, you know, word of warning, they are an estimate. They're not So, but it helps you understand where, how am I going to get to my endpoint, especially if you're getting into some of the metrics that we talk about in part two, like the decline curve analysis and others. You need that kind of volume estimate to say, well, when am I going to reach my endpoints? But again, the total volume, and this is key, includes what's recoverable. So what is you're seeing above that residual, but also the residual. And a lot of times in remedy selection, that residual is forgotten about. And that's what kills a lot of people in their remedy and why it takes longer than they think, because that residual is there, especially if you're doing a remedy that is trying to remove chemicals out of the NAPL, and you forgot about the residual. Well, you have more chemicals in the ground than you thought. And these volume estimates, again, are estimates. They tend to be on the order of magnitude level. So again, they're just used really to help you estimate what's there. So one example of that is specific volume. So what we instead of taking what you have in a well and what was measured in a well. If we take, say, that thickness in a well correlated to what was vertically in the formation. So here on the left is a boring. So we have the NAPL zone shown on the left here. And then below that is where we have no NAPL. So we take that NAPL zone. And we took all the NAPL that's in that zone and squeezed it all out, including and removed the residual and everything else. We have, in a given square foot, we have this much NAPL. There's water, and there's also soil. Well, this NAPL is the specific volume in that given square foot. So this is what is used in the API LDRM model and other models to try and harmonize what is physically present within the subsurface. So moving on to slide 43, we can take something like that, the specific volume, and we can do volume estimates. So shown here is sort of four wells with different thicknesses or specific volumes, that were calculated for the formation, and then their variability of saturation over that given specific volume. So you can establish the saturation profile for each location. So that's what's shown here in the green, these different saturation profiles. You can then estimate what the NAPL specific volume is for each location, and then you can assign a representative area. So shown here in the top, these are sort of Tyson polygons for each of the areas. And then you can calculate the volume from each of those representative areas. So, the area times the volume. And then you integrate. So you basically are adding each of those areas to calculate what is your volume in there. That's one method. There's other methods that you can apply as well. But again, volume estimates are, again, estimates. So take it with a grain of salt or as more with a little bit of NAPL. And with that, I think we're at our first Q&A. So I'm going to hand it back over to Juliana, grab some water, and you'll hear me again right after the break.
Thanks, Derek. We do have time for questions, so you're welcome to use that Q&A box in the lower right to send in your questions. We also have another poll question for our audience during this question and answer break. So in your current work, what is the general consensus related to the pancake model, the distinct layer of LNAPL floating on the water table, versus that equilibrium model that we have just described? And so we have a range here from 1 to 5. For 1, most people are still advocating that pancake model, and 5 is where we're getting to. Most people are moved on, and we're now advocating the vertical equilibrium model. So as we're going through today's question and answer break, we'll have a chance for people to answer that question. We have had a couple questions that came in. The first one I'm going to ask is related to vapor intrusion. Does the same principle for fine-grained soils holding tightly to the water molecules also apply in the vadose zone in preventing advection or advective transport of hydrocarbon vapors?
Well, we have an entire team that developed a guidance document on that. If you're not familiar with it, it's a petroleum vapor intrusion guidance document available from the IPRCweb.org website. But the tighter soils will slow the migration of hydrocarbons vertically, yes, but it will also limit the penetration of oxygen. And oxygen is needed to degrade the hydrocarbons. So, but yeah, it should aid in limiting the vertical upward migration of the off-gassing of the NAPL from the NAPL itself, and then also from the dissolved phase.
Thanks. Our next question refers to slide 26, and I'm going to try to jump back to there. On slide 26, it seems opposite logic. Higher LNAPL head pressure makes it harder to enter the pores. Seems like it'd be easier.
Well, what we're saying here is if this parameter goes up. So so if you look at the four parameters on the left, which are the four main parameters in the equation above, if you look at where those parameters are, we have interfacial tension and wettability on the top of the equation, so they're directly correlated. So as those go up, then our displacement head will also go up. So then it's harder for those to get into the pores. Whereas if our in the pore size is in the bottom of the equation, so the higher that goes, the easier it is for the NAPL to enter the pore. And then the NAPL density is a subtraction of the water. Therefore, it's making that a lower term, which then makes the top of the equation higher, which then would mean that we would need a higher NAPL displacement head. So therefore, the potential to fill the water pores is less.
Thanks. Our next question refers to slide 31 and also 33 and 34. So related to slide 33 and 34, it shows NAPL in the capillary fringe. But slide 31 in the graphics of the monitoring wells, it shows no NAPL in the capillary fringe. Can you explain?
Well, in the a well, is NAPL is just like water. If you just had a formation, an aquifer of water, we don't see water in the well that's in the capillary fringe because it's at equilibrium with air. So basically, the well is, in essence, a large pore, right? And so we don't see that drainage curve or that capillary fringe curve in a well because it's just such a large pore. So we just, similarly with an apple, we don't see that either. But in the formation, you have smaller pores or straws, if you will, and they have a retention curve to them. And then that's what that is, that drainage retention curve. So it's, you just don't measure it in a well, though, because the well is just too large of an orifice to see it.
Can you use the measured thickness in the monitoring well to estimate the dimension of the shark fin model? Is it directly related or some fraction of the shark fin?
What you see in a well, if it's a homogeneous aquifer, without any other concerns like perched or confined conditions, it's just NAPL in a formation, then the top and of the L-NAPL air interface is typically where the highest saturation is located in the formation, and where the water NAPL interface is where the base of the shark fin is. Now, that's assuming what you're measuring is the maximum thickness at that time. Now, if the maximum thickness historically was larger, then of course the formation NAPL distribution would be different than what you're measuring in the well.
Thanks. We do have additional questions, and some of these we'll try to answer right back to the person asking the question during the next half of the training. But for now, we need to continue on so we don't run out of time. And I just want to mention our poll results. So thinking about the pancake model versus the vertical equilibrium model, we can see with our poll answers from our audience that we have more people towards the vertical equilibrium model, although we still have a few pancake model advocates out there. So very interesting information, and thank you for participating in the poll questions. So moving on, slide 45, I'm going to turn it back over to Derek Tomlinson at GEI Consultants.
Thank you, Juliana. And I'm gluten-free, so I don't eat pancakes. Slide 45. So these are the exceptions to the rule. I guess if you're going to do any scientific work, you always have to have exceptions, right? So we will move on to slide 46. So some of the misperceptions now we're going to talk about napple thickness in the well is always equals the formation thickness. And this gets to the question that we just had. So moving on to slide 47. So in our classroom training, this is always a fun little exercise. I am in front of the room talking to the class, and we have a video going on in the background. But I believe the video link is available for you guys for download if you see related links after the class, not now, but links to additional resources. I believe you can actually access that video. But these are screenshots from that video. So what we have here is a plume, an El Napo body that was monitored in a gravelly sand aquifer. And it was measured over about a period, I think it was April 82 to April 87. And about 50 wells were in that measurement. And what we're seeing here is the apparent El Napo thickness. So that in-well El Napo thickness, we call that apparent. And, you know, it ranged anywhere from 0 to 4 so feet. And the groundwater elevation fluctuates about 8 feet seasonally over the course of the monitoring. And what we see here on the right-hand side, let me get my little arrow going here again, is the groundwater elevation. So these are the elevations here. And this blue bar here is just where we are in the elevation. So you can see in April 82, we were, you know, moderate. September 82, high, low in April, high in October, low, high, low. And for those Buckeyes in the crowd, I'm sure you didn't get all excited when it went, oh, high, low. I don't know, Ohio. So but the movie, when you look at it, you'll see it really illustrates clearly the influence of the water table and trapping. What we try to capture here in this screenshot here, this is an apple distribution. And you can see as the water table rises, we start to lose it because the water is now getting a higher pressure. So the pressure of the water is pushing the apple away and out of the well. And it's trapping it, it's encapsulating. And then as the water table drops, we see it show up again, and then the water table rises, it disappears. As it drops, it reappears. And this is when, for all the consultants that are listening today, this is when you should submit your closure report, when the water table is at its highest. And then the formation shows up, it's evil formation. The water table drops and the napple reappears. What I've seen in my history is that a lot of times that people think, oh my God, this new napple just got released. I said, no, it's just related to the water table elevation. So this you can get from the API Interactive LNAPL guide. It's available at the API website. I think we have a link to that as well. So looking at this then in a little more detail on slide 48. So I think we're all familiar with unconfined aquifers. What we typically see shown here on the left-hand side here in A, El Napo thickness is here on the Y, and then and our distance is just dates on the bottom. So if we have our water table shown here in the blue line going up and down, what we typically see at that high is a low napple thickness, and at the lows, a high napple thickness. So you can see that sort of flipping way. And this is one way of showing it. Another way of showing it that some people use here shown in B is looking at the LNAPL layer thickness and the water table elevation, and just showing that it's as the water table elevation rises. So this is negative water table elevations. As the water table rises in elevation, or thickness goes down. And lastly, in C, sometimes you just plot them, right? This is the years here on the bottom. This is our elevations, and you just plot all three. So here you have your water-NAPL interface, and you have your NAPL air interface shown in here in red, and then this is the piezometric surface, or the estimated water elevation. And you can see at periods of water table lows, the delta between our NAPL air interface and our NAPL water interface is really large. So again, implying a greater thickness. So what we're essentially observing here is that when the water table elevation drops, then the NAPL thickness goes up. And that's what we see in an unconfined condition. In a confined condition, we see the exact opposite. We see as the water table rises, NAPL thickness rises, and when water table drops, the water table or the NAPL thickness drops. So to go into a little more detail on the actual how what is going on, we're going to look at slide 49. So we have a new release, and we show here on the left-hand side, this is a homogeneous formation. Let's presume that. You can see a new release, so we don't have any NAPL underneath here yet. So water table, shown here on the left. Our saturation of NAPL, shown here, 0 to 1. It's normalized, so this is 100%. And we're going to show, this is our sort of shark fin that we talked about earlier. On the bottom is where we are in time. So we have our groundwater elevation on left, and we have our NAPL thickness on right. NAPL shown in red line, because we always show NAPL in red, right? And our water is shown in the blue line. So here we are, time zero of the, you know, release, our first measurement. And we have our first seasonal event, and the water table drops. So as it's dropping, it's going to leave this low three-phase residual NAPL saturation. So it's sort of what can't drain. So it's, you know, gravitational drainage. So you're leaving skid marks as you're dropping. And you're going to have this shark fin still at the new water table depth. But, you know, you can see our NAPL thickness has increased slightly because as we drop, we're draining, and it's increased. So now as we rise, we're losing this NAPL. So now we have a higher residual NAPL saturation because now this NAPL that was the intermediary phase here, it was wetting the air but non-wetting the water, is now non-wetting the water. And the water is coming up and entrapping that NAPL because the NAPL just can't get out of the pores that it's now in, and the water can easily move around it. So it's trapping that NAPL. So now you have this lower saturation of NAPL that you can see here. And then if it rises high enough and we don't have enough NAPL to continue to rise with it, it's entrapping all of that NAPL as residual, so we don't have any thickness. And then lastly, again, if we have a drop in that water table, it's now exposing that, and it's allowing that to drain down to a lower residual level, and we have a higher NAPL thickness again. So you know, this is, if you want some references and We have references in the notes on the PowerPoint, but this is Kozlowski and Chiang of groundwater in 2000 sort of walked through this in a little bit more detail. You know, that's in essence why you see the thicknesses go up and down and what's left behind as they go up and down. So slide 50. So what we generally see in respect to the vadose zone shown here in the as blue and saturated zone in this magenta relative to different soil types. And these are the residual oil saturations. What we typically see in the vadose zone or the unsaturated zone are that the residual oil saturations are lower because that napple has an ability to drain because, again, it's that intermediary wetting, non-wetting phase between air and water. So it's allowed to drain relative to the non-wetting air. So we tend to see these lower residual saturations here, shown in the blue 3D boxes, versus the saturated zone. You know, there tend to be higher residual saturations in the saturated zone. So moving on to slide 51. So some of the, non-traditional unconfined, we talked just about unconfined aquifers, so now let's just pause and have a moment to reflect on confined napple. So the napple thickness in a well increases with your increasing water levels, what we typically see with confined. Because, well, shown here on this graph, just to clarify what we're seeing here, we have a clay, which is this sort of darker gray hatching, and then a, that's overlaying a gravel. And our napple, when it's in this gravel horizon, is behaving like an unconfined napple. As the water table rises now, it hits this clay horizon, but our thickness and napple continues to rise in response to the potentiometric pressure head here shown in this little blue triangle. So we'll have this rise of napple sort of filling the well. So this, in essence, has become a pressure monitor. It's monitoring the pressure that this napple in the formation is feeling, and it's relieving its pressure into the well column. So slide 52. So if we look at this, then napple thickness versus potentiometric surface elevation, that's for confined conditions. When I noted earlier, you can see what we typically see then is water table as it fluctuates, shown here in the blue line, and this is elevation on the left and time on the bottom. The thickness of napple mirrors that response. You also have to factor in the fact that there's different densities as well. But in the confined conditions, you know, you'll see that sort of relationship. And you can have both conditions at a site, and you also can have perch. But we won't have time to get into that here in this section here today. But as a case example here, just to prove the point, you have this is a site, I believe it was actually a site out in Australia. But here's the core log for this boring here. You can see we have clay, 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 sandy silt. And then most of it's trace clay, so this is mostly sand and gravel. So we got sand and gravel underlain by mostly clay above it. So remember this number, elevation 800. You don't have to remember it through Eric Nichols' section after me, but, you know, you just need to remember it for the next slide. So this is the site here. The well that we're looking at, this is this well right here is what the core log for, and that's where it is relative to MW31. So, or this is the boring, and that's the well. So moving on to slide 54. So if we look at this is our water elevation calculated. It's potential. We have water elevations, and then we have to calculate for potentiometric. This is the MAPL thickness. Okay, so now you remember from the prior slide, we had on 53, we had that clay right at elevation 800. So now if we look at slide 54, again, on the bottom is the elevation. So you see where that dashed line is, that's where that 800 is. And this is for monitoring well 31. So this is the measured thickness. As the elevations were lower than 800, we're in that gravel. So you can see the thicknesses were dropping as the water table was rising. And then they jumped. And they continued to go upwards in that confined clay. As the potentiometric surface or the pressure head continued to rise, the thickness of the MAPL continued to rise as well. So you can have both conditions in the same well. Other weird phenomenon that happened in the subsurface that are not typically homogeneous, and then we get into the classroom training in quite a bit, is you have your unconfined water table rise, which we talked about, but we have perch conditions. So similar to confined, it's the same kind of deal. Now it's draining into a well. So now you have this exaggerated thickness relative to perch. The confined, we sort of just walk through. You have a MAPL rising up above. And then fractured, you can have fractures that are from the source, say, above a bedrock or a clay. These fractures get penetrated by a well, and you'll have an exaggerated thickness in the well formation, or in the well relative to the formation. So slide 56. So macro pores. This is some work that Mark Adamski had done when he was in the environmental field for BP. He's now up in looking for new reservoirs for them, or he's not with BP anymore, but he's up in the looking for oil reservoirs with another company. But he discovered at a site, I believe it was in Texas, that these macro pores. So here is actually a core from the site that Mark pulled out, and then they sort of scraped the clay. And they saw these little halos. I don't know if you can see them on your screen, but there's like little dark dots and then like a halo around it. So these MAPL halos. The macro pores could be from fracturing, root holes, or others, and they have really low displacement head. So because they're in essence little tiny wells, like little pipes. But they have really little amount of MAPL volume in them. But it would still show up in a well. Like here is an example from Colin Johnson. And this is, a yardstick or a meter stick, I think, in this case because of Australia. But you can see this structure, these root holes or macro pores due to roots from a dead tree that now are filled up with MAPL. But they don't hold a lot of MAPL. But if you were to drill a well here, all this MAPL would drain. You would see this huge thickness in the well. Moving on to slide 57. With respect to water table rise, so what we have here is an example that the water table rose over time. And so what we have here is a ROST. So it's like laser-induced fluorescence, which we will talk about more so in part two. But in simplistic terms, the ROST readings or the laser-induced fluorescent readings are somewhat correlative to saturation. The higher the fluorescent response from a laser-induced fluorescence, typically the higher the MAPL saturation is. What we have shown here is MAPL from this saturation via various methods. So you can see that there's a somewhat good correlation over time. But you can see that I think I just lost it again, Juliana. But you can see that the smear zone extends over about a 40 foot below ground surface where the water table was historically, down at the bottom here. Was where they put the initial screen, and then it continued to rise, and you still have some saturation, but the highest saturation is now down here in the subsurface. And so, you need to understand the history of your sites, and that's why we have this example in here. Even though you may have, like, this napple up in the well, which is shown here, and so there's one screen interval here that's capturing this zone, and then a screen interval that's across the whole formation that's capturing all the zones. Understanding the history of your site, because you may have an elevated saturation that's actually now trapped below the water table, whereas historically the water table was down here during the release. So slide 50, all right, I think we have a question right now. Yeah. Apologize. So our question that we have right now is with respect to a statement, your correct statement, what statement below here is correct? And I'm not going to bias you at all, but there's three options. LMAP full saturation is uniform at the water table like a pancake. LMAP full saturation varies at the water table depending on water level history, LMAP properties, and soil properties. Or the LNAPL thickness in wells always goes up as water level goes down. So please select your answer. Well, I think we have a fairly strong answer here. And I think we'll broadcast the results here to show everyone the results, and it looks like we are all listening today, which is thank you for listening. NAPL saturation varies at the water table depending on water level history, LNAPL properties, and soil properties, and that's correct. We did predominantly talk about unconfined, which was the third bullet, but there are other conditions that exist, and you really do need to understand your site. So moving on to the next slide. LNAPL behavior and distribution. The LNAPL is distributed at varying saturations vertically, so just remember that. It's not 100%, never 100%. LNAPL saturation also depends on your soil type and your capillary pressures, as we just talked about in that quiz. And for the slides that we went through, under unconfined conditions, the NAPL thickness will drop as the wells, as the elevation of the water table rises. And then the unconfined conditions, the NAPL thickness in the wells can be correlated to the saturation of formation, as we talked about with a specific volume and other metrics that are out there that we can use. Under perch, confined, or fractured systems, the thickness cannot be used to predict the NAPL saturation within the formation. But you need to understand those conditions, and we get into a bit more detail on those in the next two parts. And the NAPL thickness in response to the water level can be different for different aquifer systems. And with that, we're going to move on to Eric Nichols, and hopefully we can hear Eric.
Okay, thanks, Derek, and thanks everyone for attending. So Eric has gone through section one. Derek has taken us through sections two and three, and I'm going to take us home with section four, which is going to focus on how LNAPL moves. So moving to the next slide, we've gone through some of these misperceptions about LNAPL, and we're going to take on these last three in this next section, and that includes common things like if you see LNAPL in a well, it is mobile and migrating, LNAPL plumes tend to spread via groundwater flow, and the LNAPL plumes may continue to move over long timescales. Now, these misconceptions arise because it's common to assume that LNAP movement is similar to water movement. And although they're very similar, there are some differences that really need to be accounted for because of multi-phase flow, especially some concepts about relative permeability and pore entry pressure. So we'll be focusing on those concepts a bit later in the presentation. Now, Eric Gessert has already shown this slide previously to show some of the different management considerations related to LNAPL. The panel one on the lower left about emergency conditions, and the panel in the middle showing concerns two and three having to do with risk, which are pathways that are regulated by most state and federal programs. And then the final panel on the lower right, which is really where we're going to focus, these are the additional considerations about that happen when LNAPL is present in wells or is present in the subsurface by itself, sort of the occurrence-based concerns. And in particular, that item four has to do with LNAPL mobility. Now, many regulatory frameworks have addressed LNAPL in presence in wells, such as recovery to extent practicable, but fewer regulatory frameworks have really addressed LNAPL mobility and recoverability. So part of our goal today is to show the science to enable those regulations to be developed. And I'm happy to report that since we started this training program and released our regulatory guidance document, many states have done that. All right, so let's move on to slide 62. So as we previously discussed, the LNAPL saturation is going to vary up and down the soil column, and in the perfect equilibrium situation, it's going to look like this shark fin. Now, although the regulatory focus tends to address the whole spectrum of issues associated with LNAPL, when we're talking about mobility of LNAPL, it's really only relevant to the tip of that shark fin. And I'll get my pointer here and show. There we go. So this area here, above residual saturation, that's going to be the area that's relevant to mobility concerns. It's only when LNAPL saturations exceed that residual saturation that the LNAPL is potentially mobile. So moving on to slide 63, let's talk about Darcy's Law for LNAPL and some of the variations on Darcy's Law that are important as compared to water. So just like Darcy's Law controls the flow of groundwater, it does control the movement of LNAPL. But because that LNAPL and the water coexist and kind of compete for the pore space, we're not dealing with just a single fluid, so we need to address this idea that it's a multi-phase system and that there's each fluid behaves according to Darcy's Law, but there's some subtle and important differences, and we'll get into those in the next few slides. So on slide 64, got a bit of some equations here, but and I apologize for the all the nomenclature, but let's plow through this. We'll get through it together. So the first two equations there, equations one and two, just represent Darcy's Law for water flow and for NAPL flow. So Darcy's Law for water flow, the Q, which is the specific discharge for water, is equal to the product of the hydraulic conductivity times the gradient. We've probably all learned that in groundwater classes. There's an exact analogy for LNAPL flow, and we just subscript everything with an O here for to indicate oil rather than water. So oil for NAPL. So if we're going to expand that that equation two to adjust for this multi-phase concept, it's going to look like this equation three, and then a variation on that equation is equation four, and they're both basically expressing the same thing in different ways. So let's pick that apart a little bit, unpack it, if you will. So this says that the hydraulic conductivity, the LNAPL conductivity, is is going to be equal to a relative permeability times an intrinsic permeability times a density and a gravitational constant and a divided by a viscosity. So you can sort of recognize this as the typical hydraulic conductivity with some modifying factors. And the big modifying factor here is this relative permeability of L-NAPL. And we'll get into that more in a few slides. And then the second or the fourth equation here is just a restatement of that third equation. Instead of using intrinsic permeability, we just express it in terms of hydraulic conductivity. It's essentially the same thing. So what do these mean, and how are these factors affecting the flow of L-NAPL? So if we go down here to the lower right table, you can see that if the relative permeability of L-NAPL, this K sub RO, if it goes up, then the L-NAPL conductivity goes up, and the effect is to have great, all of the things being equal, the effect on L-NAPL flow will go up, or L-NAPL flow itself will go up. Density, oh, by the way, I should mention here that the L-NAPL conductivity case of zero can vary over many orders of magnitude, so this can have a big effect on L-NAPL flow. The middle line here, the L-NAPL density, it doesn't vary so much, but it can vary a little. If it goes up, then the L-NAPL conductivity goes up, and the effect on L-NAPL flow is to increase the flow. But that's a fairly small effect in the real world, because L-NAPL densities don't vary that much. A little bit more significant is the viscosity. When it goes up, a more viscous fluid, such as a diesel compared to gasoline, then the oil conductivity goes down and the flow goes down. And we'll see some illustrations of that in a few slides. So on the next slide, 65, the L-NAPL conductivity also varies with saturation. And this illustrates that both the effect of saturation and the effect of change in viscosity. So first, an increase in saturation can increase this ratio of L-NAPL conductivity to saturated hydraulic conductivity. So in other words, as more pores are filled with L-NAPL, the L-NAPL conductivity starts to become a bigger fraction of the water conductivity. It's always less, but it can start to grow and become more like the water conductivity as those pores get fuller and fuller with L-NAPL. Also notice here that as the L-NAPL gets more viscous, then the L-NAPL conductivity drops, and things are more resistive to flow because of the greater viscosity of the fluid. So there are typically some distinct differences between petroleum products. There you can also have in the real world a lot of weathering and some mixtures of petroleum products. So although it's interesting to think about these fresh products and their differences, in the real world, you may want to go out and measure viscosity and look at the types of products you actually have because they can vary over time and space. So to summarize these relationships, the L-NAPL conductivity decreases as the viscosity increases. And for saturation, the L-NAPL conductivity goes up as the L-NAPL saturation goes up. So on slide 66, let's talk about that relative permeability. And this, you can think of this as kind of a scaling factor that tells you how close to 100% permeability you can achieve based on your saturation. So here you let's look at this chart. And on the horizontal axis, we have both L-NAPL saturation in red and water saturation in blue. So at 100% L-NAPL saturation, which is sort of theoretically impossible, but we can imagine it, all of the pores are filled with L-NAPL, all the way down to the smallest ones, and the relative permeability is at 1, or essentially 100% of the potential permeability you can have for that NAPL. As the saturation of LNAPL diminishes, you get a rapid change in relative permeability, starts to drop, and eventually at some point it drops to near zero. Water follows kind of an inverse relationship to this. When the pores are full of oil, they're not full of water, and the water saturation is zero, and the relative permeability of water is zero. And then water saturation goes up, water relative permeability goes up. So the sum of the relative permeabilities of LNAPL and water are inversely related, and they both sum to one. So as one goes down, the other goes up. They both sum to one. So what does that mean in the real world? Let's take a look at slide 67 and relate this theoretical concept to actual LNAPL movement. So this slide relates the relative permeability to the saturations one might expect in different parts of an LNAPL plume. So in the core of the plume, as Derek has mentioned earlier, saturations are higher, so you tend to get these higher relative permeabilities to LNAPL. And in the edges of the plume, saturations of LNAPL are lower, consequently the relative permeability will be lower. And you can kind of think of this as in the concept of mobility as these two rowers. So here in the middle of the plume where saturations are higher, relative permeability is higher, the potential for mobility of that LNAPL is greater. So it's like having two rowers. And then near the edge here, saturations are lower, relative permeability is lower, and the potential for LNAPL mobility is lower. And in fact, as you get all the way out to this edge, you can get zero rowers or zero mobility. And then it's also, what's not shown here is the influence of gradient. Now, during earlier time periods, after a release, there may be greater mounding of LNAPL, so some steeper and higher LNAPL gradients. And during those periods of high gradient, the LNAPL is going to spread more laterally. And then as that gradient dissipates, the LNAPL gradient or the LNAPL movement will decrease. And we'll talk more about that movement in a minute. But before we do, let's go to slide 68. And Derek already showed this core image of fluorescing LNAPL from Mark Adamski. And the purpose here is just to remind us that where we have that high fluorescence, which tends to be in the coarse grain material, which is where you expect to see the NAPL invade the pores more readily, that where you have that high permeability or high coarse grain material, you'll have the highest LNAPL content. And in that high LNAPL content, you'll have the highest relative permeability and thus the highest potential for LNAPL to flow. So just kind of bringing that all together. High saturation of LNAPL, higher potential for LNAPL mobility. Now, slide 69, we've been focusing on LNAPL conductivity and movement, but it's important to come back to some concepts relating to displacement head and LNAPL migration, because those are also really key in terms of influencing the overall movement of an LNAPL body and its stability. So an important concept here is that there is a minimum LNAPL displacement entry pressure or head that must be overcome for LNAPL to invade into a water-wet pore, and Derek has covered that. Now, that displacement head can in turn be related to the thickness of LNAPL in the formation. So you've got a larger accumulation of LNAPL over a greater thickness. That sort of pushes down on the LNAPL, pushes it sideways, and allows it to invade adjacent water-wet pores. Now, as indicated earlier, that LNAPL spreading is controlled by that displacement air entry pressure, and that's consistent with field observations. There's some models out there, some by Randy Charbonneau, that have attempted to relate those minimum threshold of mobility to thickness of L-NAPL in wells, so taking that even one step further, not just the L-NAPL thickness in the formation, but the observed L-NAPL thickness in a well. And there's still some active research on that and debate about how accurate that is. And for all the reasons we've talked about, that a well is not necessarily representative of the L-NAPL conditions in the formation. So the big point here is that water acts as a capillary barrier against continued L-NAPL spreading. So you can have some internal mobility here, but some a point at which saturations diminish and heads diminish to the point where continued L-NAPL spreading doesn't occur. So internal mobility, but external footprint stability is a way to think of that. So let's move on to slide 70, which sort of says what I just said in another way. So this slide brings together those concepts that we've been discussing. On the left here, we have that relative permeability relationship, indicating the potential for mobility of L-NAPL when saturation is greater than residual saturation. So let's say here's the residual saturation shown by this red dashed line. When the NAPL is greater saturation than that, it can potentially move if the gradient and the heads are high enough. On the right is this conceptual model of a L-NAPL plume that shows spreading of the L-NAPL being controlled by resistive forces along the perimeter. So the key point here is that the potential L-NAPL mobility within the core of the plume doesn't necessarily equate to spreading of an L-NAPL body or an expanding L-NAPL footprint. You can have some internal rearrangement or potential mobility, but overall, in many instances, with flat enough L-NAPL gradients and an old enough plume, and especially when coupled with natural source zone depletion, which we'll talk more about in future modules, then you can have footprint stability. So on slide 71, let's talk about the time scale or sort of life cycle of a release, because that's very important. There's going to be time scales over which that L-NAPL mobility is important, and then there's timescales where it becomes less important. So in this slide and the next slide, we'll summarize this concept that there must be a minimum L-NAPL head to overcome that L-NAPL displacement pressure for the L-NAPL footprint to expand. Now, in early times in a release, especially with large volumes of release, there's a large L-NAPL head here, this sort of integrated thickness of L-NAPL in pores. And when that large head occurs, then there's enough sideways push, so to speak, to allow that L-NAPL to invade water-wet pores. And then over long times, as that volume distributes over a larger soil volume, where the L-NAPL volume distributes over a larger soil volume, that L-NAPL head is dissipated, and there's no longer sufficient head to overcome that displacement entry pressure. So further footprint expansion ceases at that point. And that can happen in a matter of months to years, you know, sort of depending on the situation and the amount of volume released. Looking at slide 72, let's illustrate some of these concepts with two case examples over the next two slides that talk about L-NAPL mobility. But before we get there, let's talk about some general observations. First of all, L-NAPL can initially spread at rates that are higher than groundwater flow because that L-NAPL head and the L-NAPL gradients might be greater than the equivalent water situation near it. L-NAPL can spread in an opposite direction to groundwater gradient, you know, sort of a radial spreading, which you can often see around a recent or a larger release. And then finally, L-NAPL bodies may come to stable configurations in relatively short periods based on the factors that we've just discussed. So let's take a look at some, two cases that illustrate that. On the next slide, on 73, this first case example is actually a model result, a simulated result, of an instantaneous L-NAPL release of 1,500 cubic meters of product in this release area here. And the images represent time history, a predicted time history of the migration of that LNAPL body in terms of what you'd observe in LNAPL thickness in a well or in multiple wells around this release. So this first year one shows a certain LNAPL body footprint around that release area. Year five shows the slightly expanded LNAPL body footprint using the same contour intervals there. And then all the way up to year 56, like maybe a little tiny more, bit more spreading between years 5 and 56, but not much. So pretty clearly most of that spreading happened in year 1, a little bit in the next few years, and then hardly any for the next few decades. So it's interesting to note, too, in this particular simulation, the groundwater gradient was quite flat, hence the sort of radial spreading. But groundwater would have moved about 600 meters in that same period of time, whereas the LNAPL has maybe gone as up to about 100 meters. So looking at slide 74, in this second case example, this is a real site with some real measure data. This happens to be a crude oil release at a pipeline. So in this upper left figure, the gray area represents the spreading of that crude oil LNAPL between the time the release occurred and about a year and a half later, from February 2000 to October 2001. And then the colored contours, the blue and yellow, represent some additional spreading that happened over the next year or so. So an important characteristic here to note is that spreading was radial, so it wasn't just in the direction of groundwater flow, which is shown here. The release is here, so we actually got some upgradient movement of that LNAPL, as we mentioned before. So this figure in the lower right shows the estimated rate of LNAPL spreading based on monitoring data. And initially, it was several feet per day. But not long into the lifespan of that plume, it started to slow down. And over time, as that LNAPL had dissipated, the approximate spreading rate sort of asymptoted out and became effectively zero. So at some point down here, the LNAPL plume is functionally stable, which represents a condition where there may be some minor vertical and lateral redistribution of LNAPL, because things aren't always in perfect equilibrium, especially with rising and lowering water tables and so on. But that additional movement is relatively minor and probably won't impact any ongoing plume management decisions. So one thing that's not shown here is the dissolved phase plume that's probably being born off of this LNAPL plume. But another indication of LNAPL stability here would be the stability of that dissolved phase plume. So if you've got a dissolved phase plume that is itself stable or shrinking, then it's quite likely that the LNAPL plume that is giving birth to that dissolved plume is also stable, or at least unlikely to be expanding. So speaking of stability, let's move on to talk about some ways in which to assess that plume stability. And I got sort of a blank slide here, so I'm just going to ask Juliana if, Juliana,
yeah,
I'm
seeing the slide, so just, it may take a moment to load on yours. So.
Oh, yeah, it's probably just some kind of delay. But going on to slide 75, hoping that I'm showing slide 75 right now. So how do we go ahead and evaluate LNAPL stability? There's a few lines of evidence for that, and the next few slides are going to go into those lines of evidence. So we want to think about this in terms of a multiple lines of evidence approach, and there's kind of a hierarchy of evidence here. The intent here is to provide an overview of that approach. And it's based on the guidance that we developed with the LNAPL team, and that guidance has additional details. So the first line of evidence, and typically the most important one, would be monitoring results from monitoring wells. And the idea here is that if you have an adequate monitoring network with sufficient data over time, there are going to be three factors that are evidence for a stable footprint. And the first is going to be that there's a stable or decreasing LNAPL occurrence in monitoring wells. And the second would be that there that sentinel wells outside that LNAPL footprint remain free of LNAPL. And then the third thing would be that you have a stable or shrinking dissolved phase plume. So that's kind of what we were talking about before, about the dissolved phase being an indicator of the LNAPL stability. So that's monitoring data is the first line of evidence. The second might be to look at LNAPL velocities, so you can calculate those using Darcy's law. In order to do that, you need to know what the LNAPL conductivity is, and there are many ways to do that, including bail down tests, and we go into that much more detail in the next module. There's also some interactive tools like the API LNAPL guide that can allow you to do that. And there's even some guidance documents that suggest the minimum LNAPL velocity below which you sort of assume it's not really mobile. And then there's some exceptions to all this, like fractured bedrock, like we talked about earlier. There's also some ways to estimate LNAPL velocity kind of directly with tracer dilution tests. That's kind of an emerging practice. So I'm going to attempt to go on to slide 76. I'm still seeing blank slides, so I'll just assume that you're seeing slide 76 along with me. A third line of evidence in this multiple lines of evidence for footprint stability would be to compare the measured LNAPL thicknesses to a calculated threshold LNAPL thickness in wells that equates to a displacement entry head. There's still some debate on the use of that, as we indicated earlier, but it's another line of evidence. And then fourth are recovery rates. If you have active hydraulic recovery and the rates are diminishing over time, then generally declining recovery rates are going to suggest a reduced potential for LNAPL mobility. And then fifth line of evidence would be the age of the release. Generally, younger releases are going to have a greater potential for mobility, and older releases, because of weathering and compositional change and natural source zone depletion, that mobility is going to diminish. And then a sixth and final line of evidence would be field and laboratory tests. So you can actually measure LNAPL saturations from cores, and you can even measure the residual saturation using a centrifuge test. And these are approximate tests, and they tend to over-predict mobility, but they're yet another line of evidence. And I think with that, it's time for us to pop up an online survey, which I am seeing. Poll. Thank you, Juliana. So just to check your attention span and level of engagement, we are asking you to select one correct statement out of these three. The first choice is that LNAPL continues to migrate indefinitely. Second is that LNAPL saturation is unaffected by soil properties. And the third is that LNAPL occurrence in wells is not an indicator of an expanding LNAPL footprint. So go ahead and place your votes. And it looks like most of you, or many of you, have finished voting, and the overwhelming choice is the third one, and that's good. Just because LNAPL's in a well doesn't mean that it's that you have an expanding LNAPL footprint for many of the reasons we talked about. So thank you for doing that. Let's go ahead and close that off, Juliana, and I'll just wrap up with a few. A couple of summary slides. So on slide 77, which hopefully you're seeing, I want to first of all sort of summarize some of what we learned about LNAPL migration. So potential LNAP velocity can be estimated from Darcy's law, but as we've talked about, it's not exactly equivalent to Darcy's law for water because of some modifying parameters, and the key one being their relative permeability, which is a function of saturation. So it's important to recognize that once an LNAP release stops, the LNAP near the water table will eventually cease to spread because of those resistive forces and that water displacement that we talked about earlier, that it takes force for LNAP to displace water out of a pore because water is the wetting fluid, as Derek mentioned. The smaller releases are going to stop migrating sooner. And conversely, if you have an ongoing release, say at an active facility, then you can have a growing LNAP bloom, one that doesn't stabilize because you're feeding it, essentially. Now, while an LNAP bloom or body may be stable, you can have some redistribution of LNAP within the core, and you can have some varying thickness of LNAP observed in wells, especially over time as water levels go up and down and various hydraulic influences are exerted on that LNAP body. So moving on to slide 78, further summary here, LNAPs are not distributed vertically as a pancake, but really they're in this multi-phase saturation distribution that looks like a shark fin. The saturations aren't uniform in that shark fin, but they are highest near the point of that fin, and they diminish upward and downward, both into the capillary fringe and into the saturated zone. Now, we can account for all the LNAP in that shark fin through the concept of specific volume, and it's the specific volume of LNAP in a soil is going to be greater in a coarse-grain soil than a fine-grain soil for any given LNAP thickness, and that's because LNAP likes to invade larger pores, and therefore there's going to be more oil in them. And now, as the LNAP saturation increases, the relative permeability and the potential LNAP velocity also increase. So higher saturations equate to greater potential mobility. So let's take a look at slide 79 to continue our summary. The pressure exerted by LNAP needs to exceed that displacement pore entry pressure in order for that LNAP to enter a water-filled pore. Key concept. Water is the wetting fluid. The measurable LNAP thickness in a well does not necessarily indicate mobility, and LNAP plumes tend to come to stable configurations over a relatively short period of time, and those periods of time might be months or years, depending on the situation. So that's it for the summary. I just want to do a shout-out for the next part in this Part 3 training. Our part two is going to address LNAP characterization and site conceptual model development, as well as LNAP recovery evaluation and remedial considerations. So it's taking these fundamentals and really starting to apply them. Specifically, part two is going to look at key LNAP and site data and what data is most important and how to get those data. And it's also going to talk about LNAP recoverability. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Juliana for our second question and answer break.
Thanks, Eric. We do have a few minutes for questions, but before I get to those, I do want to tell you about our links page where we have more information available, including links to register for Part 2. So if you have not yet registered for Part 2, do it now. It's a great time to get that registration in so that you are sure to be able to attend the Part 2 class. We also ask you to fill out our feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. It's also your opportunity to create a certificate of participation for today's class. If you have more than one person at your location, you can fill it out for the first person. Once you submit, there's a link on that next page that's going to allow you to go back. So each person at your location can have a certificate for attending today's class. I also have a couple new poll questions open. Do you agree with the corrections to the common misconceptions described today? And thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC training, the information that we've just covered? So we're going to try to get to as many questions as we can in the next 5 minutes. Do you recommend conducting a compound-specific isotope analysis, CSIA, as one of the multiple lines of evidence for determining the degree of weathering?
I'll take that on. I'd say, in general, no. If you're in a situation where you're trying to attribute source to a particular responsible party, it might make more sense. But in terms of assessing the degree of weathering, I'm not sure it gives you the information you need.
Based on your collective experience, what is the farthest distance up gradient that LNAPL can radially spread?
Oh, my. In my personal experience, it's, you know, tens to hundreds of feet, but not more than hundreds. But I think it's going to depend a lot on the, you know, the volume that's lost. A really catastrophic loss in a coarse-grained sediment with a flat groundwater table, you might be able to beat those numbers. So I guess it all depends.
Can you expand on the conceptual LNAPL dissolve phase migration over time on the upgradient side of the release?
The dissolve phase, go ahead.
The dissolve phase will, the LNAPL is the source and groundwater is flowing in one direction across that source. So the dissolve phase is contaminants coming out of the source into the groundwater. So it will flow down gradient from the source. So the highest particle of concentration you would have is at wherever the water table is heading. Now, if you have seasonal variability, then of course you might have the directional changes. But if you have like one direction of groundwater, then it should not be up gradient of the NAPL body.
Thank you. What is the effect of well bore diameter on apparent LNAPL thickness in a well casing?
If you have, if you have a small enough, a really tiny, 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 tiny well and a really, then yeah, it might have some effect. But like a well itself, if you have sufficient saturation in the near field of the nap of the well, there should not be an effect. But the larger the well you have and the water and you extract that volume, then you're going to have a larger radius of influence of NAPL that can migrate towards it, so it could affect the thickness, but theoretically it should not.
A question came in, where can I find these slides for later review? And anyone interested in the slides right now, if you follow that links to additional resources, follow that link at the top of that page, download ITRC's training. That's going to give you a link where you can download a PDF or the PowerPoint file. And remember, in both of those, there's more information available in the notes section of the downloaded version. Another question, I did not understand why, when LNAPL thickness increase with the water table decrease.
It's the other way around. LNAPL is responding to the hydraulic forces imposed by the water. So when the water table rises, in an unconfined condition, when the water table rises, the NAPL is pushed out of the well, in essence. And as we talked through on the examples, you get the NAPL, in essence, is getting trapped into the formation and doesn't show up in the well anymore. It's the water that's imposing forces on the NAPL, not the other way around.
What about the effect of temperature on the ability of LNAPL to migrate? For example, after an incomplete application of a thermal remediation, where does the temperature factor come into the conductivity equation?
Well, viscosity is a function of temperature. Mm-hmm. So when you have a warmer subsurface, you can reduce the viscosity of the fluid of the elm apples. So it can become relatively more mobile in warmer situations.
Yeah, what you see, the heavier apples like crude oils and the like, they could be mobile still or and potentially migrating from the release decades later. That's because the viscosity is so high, it takes it a very long time to find its stability, whereas in most elm apple releases, the middle to low distillates, so your gas, diesel, and fuel oils will find their stability somewhat quickly. But it's really high viscous oil will take a longer time to find its stability, which is related to viscosity. And so if you can lower the viscosity, heat being one of them, then they'll spread more easily and find their stability more easily. And heating is typically done for those heavier fractions. So if you don't capture all the heavier fraction, then it could spread to a greater distance. But for the heating technologies, that thermal energy tends to dissipate rather quickly once the energy sources are turned on.
Thank you. We are out of time today. If you had a question that we did not get to and you would still like an answer, you can email us such question at training@itrcweb.org. You're also welcome to respond to any of our reminder emails or your email confirmation for today's class. We'll go ahead and wrap up. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. Please fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information. We're getting ready to develop a new course with the Elm Apple Update team, so we're going to directly use the information you provide in the feedback as we're developing new courses. So please give us your feedback. It's also your opportunity to get a certificate for today's training. Right now, the only way to get that is through the feedback form,